There's no way to build sustainable trails without these RTP funds. They're critical.
An important funding source for recreational trails in Alaska is threatened. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 5th. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. The extensive process of dismantling the pirate vessel Bangun Perkasa.
Approximately 70,000 pounds of fishing nets from that hole.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Bristol Bay fishermen at the mouth of the Igoochik River were shut down again this afternoon following reports of oil in their nets. An aerial survey flown earlier today observed a mile and a half long sheen of oil coming from the sunken tender Lone Star. KDLG's Dave Benninger reports.
The 78-foot Lone Star has been sitting submerged in the mouth of the Igoochik River, pretty much undisturbed by all but the wind and the waves since sinking last Sunday morning. Earlier in the week, things didn't look too bad. What sheen there had been initially had mostly dissipated, and Magone Marine divers, contracted by the U.S. Coast Guard, were supposed to seal off fuel tank vents Wednesday evening, a step one in the salvaging efforts. Now, Friday, that still hasn't happened.
It was intended that the fuel vents would be plugged last night, but tides were lower than expected, and so during the window they had to get in there, they were not able to access the river.
That's Tom Callahan of the Meredith Management Group, who has the title of Incident Commander of the Unified Command responding to the Lone Star. The latest situation report states that someone miscalculated the low tide for the river, and the divers missed their opportunity. Callahan said the plan is to dive tonight's slack water tide at around 7 p.m., but that won't come soon enough for the fishermen in Igoochik, who were shut down again today at 1 p.m.
We've got reports of oiled nets and stuff, and there's just no tolerance for that, so we had to close it.
Tim Sands is an area management biologist with the Department of Fish and Game. Sands was on board an aerial survey earlier today where it was clear to him the situation had gotten much worse.
It's now completely submerged at most tide stages, and it's leaking more fuel than previously. There was a much more significant and visible sheen, and it was rainbow sheen, and previously it had been a light silver sheen, and there were places where it looked like the sheen was kind of pooling up.
The other marine salvage company involved, Alaska Chidoe, just finished refitting a 32-foot gill netter in Dillingham with an oil boom and a skimmer pump system. That vessel left Dillingham earlier today with the intention it could begin skimming the wreck site by tonight. Igoochik fishermen were shut down last Sunday and part of Monday after the Lone Star sank. They've been fishing hard the past few days to make up for that lost time. The escapement of sockeye up the Igoochik River remains strong this week, but no one knows how long that'll last, nor how long the fishing will remain closed. A claims hotline has now been established for those affected by the spill and the closure. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
A fishing tender is under the Coast Guard's close watch after it intentionally grounded on a western Prince William Sound island yesterday. The Coast Guard says the Hannah Cove took on water after it struck a rock. Coast Guard spokesperson Lieutenant Ali Furco says a Good Samaritan vessel arrived on scene to assist the 65-foot Hannah Cove.
But at a certain point, they realized that their pumps weren't going to be able to keep up with the incoming water. So they intentionally grounded themselves onto Colross Island.
Colross Island is located 18 miles west of Whittier. The vessel has been tied up and the crew was transported to Whittier. No injuries or pollution have been reported. A response crew from Cordova has been hired to remove the remaining fuel on board and salvage the vessel. The pirate rat ship is no more. The Coast Guard seized the FV Bangun Perkasa almost 2 years ago while it was illegally drift netting in the North Pacific, a practice that's banned by a United Nations moratorium because of its indiscriminate harvest. Now the ship is on its way to the scrapyard. As KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports, dismantling the stateless vessel was a lengthy process.
What's left of the Bangoon Picasa, and it isn't much, is tied up at the Mago Marine dock in Dutch Harbor. The whole top of the vessel is gone. All that's left is the rusty hull, which looks like a giant metal canoe. Mago Marine safety manager Ava Lund says it's been more than 2 months since they started stripping down the ship.
We started first removing all the hazardous material.
That included the asbestos-ridden insulation and all the fuels and fluids. Lund says the fuels in particular took a while because they were stored all over the ship in small containers and barrels.
Some of them we are able to reuse, like the fuel is diesel number 2.
Lund says from there they began tearing pieces off the vessel, starting with the upper deck.
The wheelhouse and everything, right now we're working on the bottom section.
Before getting to the bottom section, though, the scrapping crew had to pull all the fishing net off the ship. And it ended up being much more than anyone anticipated.
Approximately 70,000 pounds of fishing nets from that hole.
That's more than 80 miles of drift net. Lund says they packed the net into over 1,000 bags that will eventually be hauled to the Unalaska landfill. The hope is that it can be recycled at some point, but for now it's just being ripped up so it can't go back into the water. The foam and wood from the ship are also headed for the landfill, but the metal will be sent down to Seattle. Mago Marine subcontracted with Ron Moore, who's on island doing other scrap metal cleanup, to take away what's left of the ship. Moore plans to bring the empty shell of the vessel up onto shore in the next few days and then cut it into pieces. Then, the Bangoon Picasa will be no more. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Public Affairs Director Connie Barkley says completely scrapping the ship ensures it will never go back to illegal fishing. NOAA wouldn't disclose exactly how much they paid Mago Marine to dismantle the vessel, but owner Dan Magone told the Dutch Harbor fishermen earlier this year that the contract was several $100,000. Barkley says the total cost of seizing the vessel, keeping it tied up at Magone's for the better part of 2 years, and then scrapping it is estimated at $1.1 million. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
This holiday week is a prime time for Alaskans to go out and play outside, whether it's with bicycles, ATVs, or hiking boots. There are hundreds of miles of trails available for use across the state, and much of that system is developed and maintained with federal funding. But now some of that money is at risk of drying up, and outdoor enthusiasts are worried about what that could mean for recreation in the state. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Curry.
It's a clear Fairbanks day, and Jeffrey Orth is taking his golden retriever out for a little bit of exercise at Esther Dome.
We typically do at least a couple of 3 mile or 4 mile runs every week, and then if she's in shape, we'll do a 12 mile bike or 20 mile bike.
One of their favorite places to go is the Happy Valley Trail, a narrow mountain biking course that rides like a roller coaster. The trail cuts through a sloping forest and is intricate and winding. Orth shows me just how complex it is when we stop by a map.
We're right here at the top of that triangle. There is an outer loop going around, and that's about 6.5 miles. There is an inner loop, which is the yellow moving around, and that's about 3.5. And then we have this tight and twisty, that triangle or diamond shape there.
The whole thing was built a couple of years ago to the tune of $200,000. Much of that money came from a federal grant distributed by the Recreational Trails Program, or RTP, which sends $1 million to Alaska annually. As president of the recreation nonprofit Alaska Trails, Orth is a huge fan of RTP, so he got a little bit nervous when he learned that the program could go away next year.
There's no way to build sustainable trails without these RTP funds. They're critical.
The reason RTP is in danger of disappearing is complicated. Up until now, some of RTP's operating costs were covered by an Alaska-only trails program created by the late Senator Ted Stevens. With Congress going through a belt-tightening phase, that program is scheduled to go away this fall. But it was essential for maintaining federal RTP funds. So there's a domino effect, with RTP potentially being victim of a smaller program getting cut. To stop this from happening, trails advocates like Orth say the state of Alaska needs to step in and cover RTP's operating costs. His group, Alaska Trails, teamed up with snow machine clubs, trail organizations, and officials from the Fairbanks North Star Borough, the Matsu Borough, and Skagway to call upon the governor to make up the shortfall. Ben Ellis directs the Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation. He says the state is looking into it and acknowledges that the funding situation is uncertain.
How we move forward is up in the air, and we'll be discussing that as we start working on budget issues coming up this summer.
Because the budget for this fiscal year has already gone into effect, the state's somewhat limited in what it can do until the legislature meets again. But Ellis says they still might have a few options. They could maybe roll funding for RTP into a supplemental budget package, or they could try to reduce operating costs by awarding a few large grants instead of a lot of smaller ones. Ellis adds that he's optimistic that they'll find a way to keep RTP running.
We're very supportive of it. We think it's a fantastic program.
RTP funding is set to expire in October, and state officials are meeting later this month to discuss the program status. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the storied history of Homer's Salty Dog Saloon.
Whatever was killed that week was eaten, you know, bear stew or, you know, halibut chowder or moose burgers or something like that.
Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Six passengers and their pilot are safely in Talkeetna today after three nights weathered in the foot of Denali. John Nealon was flying a de Havilland Beaver belonging to Talkeetna Air Taxi on a flight seeing tour Tuesday afternoon when the weather forced him to make an unscheduled landing on the Ruth Glacier. The weather kept Nealon and his passengers there until this morning, when another pilot was able to find a brief weather window to reach Nealon's landing site. While on the glacier, the passengers were able to sleep inside the plane, which is equipped with sleeping bags, food, and other survival gear. Yesterday, the National Park Service sent four mountaineering rangers with additional supplies via helicopter. The rangers were dropped off further down the glacier and hiked in with the extra gear. The passengers who were on board did not wish to be interviewed, but one stated that she is grateful for Nealon's decision to land and for the professionalism of Talkeetna Air Taxi and the National Park Service. A large timber sale in the Tongass National Forest, called a Big Thorn, was announced on Monday, combining old and second growth areas of Prince of Wales Island. Layla Carey of member station KRBD has more.
150 million board feet is a big timber sale. As Forest Supervisor Forrest Cole points out, that's potentially good news for loggers and mill operators like Viking Lumber outside of Klawak.
The Viking mill harvests about 23 million a year. So this could be, if they were successful bidders on the project, this could be a substantial, you know, boost to their supply.
But the size of the sale is not good news for conservationists who are worried about wildlife habitat. Bob Kloss is with the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council.
This is a huge sale. It's double the size of the last biggest sale since the pulp mill era, and it's just a continuation of the too much logging, too fast policies of timber management on the Tongass.
The harvest area includes timber stands near Kaufman Cove and Thorn Bay. It allows construction of 46 miles of road, which includes reconstruction of about 36 miles. According to the Forest Service, none of that harvest would take place in inventoried roadless areas. Cole says the sale could provide up to a decade's worth of timber for mid-size mills like Viking and sets aside acreage for smaller operations.
Somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 million feet, which is a huge supply for them.
He says that when making the decision, he considered public comments and other factors such as wildlife and economic needs. He estimates that the project could generate nearly 700 jobs. The selected alternative was modified to mitigate some wildlife habitat concerns by reducing some of the old growth and winter harvest, and it keeps the roads open following the harvest for up to 5 years rather than closing them immediately. POW residents have expressed frustration over the closure of old logging roads, which provide easier access for hunting. Cole adds that the sale will give everyone time to figure out how to make a second growth timber economy work.
By providing a stable supply of timber to the industry now, They're giving the Forest Service and the industry the breathing space needed for a transition to young growth timber in the future.
But the large amount of old growth included in this ROD is of particular concern to Claus and SEAC.
For us, you know, the habitat is almost synonymous with the old growth forest, and the remaining reserves inside the Big Thorn Project area are the places where we need to keep for deer habitat in particular.
The ROD announcement marks the start of the appeal process. Claus says it's too early to say whether his organization will appeal the decision.
I would think that we will be looking very carefully at it. At least we'll be trying to clarify some details, but I don't know exactly what process we'll be using.
Cole says he's confident there will be appeals. They could delay the process, especially if those appeals aren't resolved and lead to lawsuits. However, if all goes smoothly,
we hope to advertise this project around the middle of August and have a bid opening the middle of September. And if we can achieve those two objectives, then we could potentially award this project by the end of September.
In that case, logging could commence as early as this year. In Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
The state has given the go-ahead to a coal lease for the Skwentna area. The Division of Mining, Land, and Water released its final decision today on the Canyon Creek coal lease. Bill Cole with the Department of Natural Resources says the lease area encompasses more than 13,000 acres. Cole says the decision to move ahead with a lease sale does not mean an exploration permit has been approved.
This notice is the notice to hold a competitive lease sale for the acreage. It does not provide for any kind of physical activity on the ground.
According to Cole, the state was asked to consider the lease area by Alaska Energy Corporation, a subsidiary of Canada's Can-Am Coal. Tim Leach with the citizens group Envision Matsu says expanded coal development in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough area is harmful to residents' health and has dubious economic benefits.
We have seen huge fluctuations in the price of coal on the global level. And if we're seeing that right now, why would we think that this is going to change for the future? Why would we say, let's hitch our wagon to coal? With the volatility in the market for coal specifically, we'll see that continuation of a boom-bust economy if we go that direction.
The lease area, about 18 miles from Skwentna, has no infrastructure.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Stephanie Joyce. This week on AK, Saloon Secrets. If you've ever visited Homer, chances are you've stopped by the Salty Dog Saloon, or at least seen the t-shirts and hoodies that have made their way all over the world. The bar itself is a 105-year-old relic of days gone by on the Homer Spit, and a sort of living museum to Alaska's homesteader days. KBBI's Aaron Sells.
On a day
Alaska's best-known buildings.
On a day when chilly winds are ripping through the tents and campers on the Homer Spit, it seems like a pretty good idea to head indoors, and what better place than the Salty Dog Saloon. Attending bar today is Larry Bain.
Better known as LB. I've been here for about 10 years or so.
LB says life moves pretty fast when you're working the bar at the Salty Dog.
More or less people just come and see what the Salty Dog is all about. Somebody's recommended that if you go to Homer, you need to go stop at the Salty Dog and get a t-shirt and check out the place and see how many people are hanging out that you might know from the old days or meet new people.
LB is not just a bartender, he's also the dog's unofficial resident historian.
He says the original building, where the bar is now, was one of the first homesteader cabins in Homer, built around 1898 and located at the very end of the spit, where Land's End Resort is now. The building served as a residence, a general store, and an office for the Alaska Coal Company. Three other buildings have been added to the structure over the years, including the cone-shaped lighthouse, which was originally built to house a water tank. It wasn't until 1957, 2 years before Alaska would become a state, that the Salty Dog would become a bar like it is today. Back then, the place was known as the Salty Pup, and in addition to Olympia beer and Seagram 7 whiskey, it also served food.
Which was whatever was killed that week was eaten, you know, the bear stew or, you know, halibut chowder or moose burgers or something like that.
LB shows me the lighthouse tower on the fourth floor, which sits over an office and a small apartment.
We can go up there and you can check this out too. I don't know if you want to try to get up in there or just crawl up there and look.
Okay, maybe I'll just stick my head in.
Yeah.
The lighthouse is indeed a functioning nautical landmark, marked on official NOAA maps and visible for miles out to sea. For boat captains and for us landlubbers, the lighthouse also functions as an open and closed sign. When the light is on, the bar is open.
They actually have called from out by Soldovia or somewhere and said, we just saw the light go off. Can you wait till we get there? We've been on the boat for 2 months, and we'd like to have some cocktails. And most of the time, the bartender will wait for them.
Back down in the bar, a steady stream of people are coming in. Some locals and fishermen who are there to drink and socialize, and some tourists who are there to buy a t-shirt or just gawk at all of the unique stuff pinned to the walls.
And as you can see, there's carvings on all the doors and walls and dollar bills and a few pieces of lingerie that usually come right after the tequila hits.
People sometimes propose in the bar via a message on a dollar bill. Others leave raunchy messages for their friends, while some create memorials to friends or family that have passed on.
Last I heard, it was basically all started from old fishermen way back in the day who would put up money for buying drinks for other fishermen who were out in, you know, sea, waiting for them to come back, and they couldn't wait for them, so they'd buy drinks for them.
That's local fisherman David McRory. He's back by the pool table with a dollar bill in hand, looking for a place to leave a note for his buddy, a fellow fisherman. After a minute of hunting around for an open spot, McRory finally settles on one.
I think I might just do it right over the men's bathroom.
There we go.
There you go. Right on George Washington's face.
Right on his face. Hopefully he'll see it.
So how many dollar bills are plastered to the walls of the Salty Dog?
Well, a few years ago, we had a math professor from Cornell or Brown or somewhere down there in the States, and he sat in the corner over there with his big calculator and finally came over to me and said, well, according to my calculations, you got about 35,000 on the walls.
Other artifacts include glass buoys, sculptures made out of beer cans, an original t-shirt from Woodstock, signed by a few of the musicians who performed there, and a human skull that was found washed up on the beach in the 1950s. Sheila Turner is from Greenville, Texas. She's on her first trip to the Salty Dog.
I've never been to Alaska before, period.
Turner first caught a glimpse of the saloon on the Discovery Channel's Deadliest Catch, which often shows crew members from the FV Time Bandit hanging out at the dog. And I don't know if it was the Salty Dog, Ketchumak Bay, or what, but something about the place clearly made an impression on her.
Actually, I'm going to end up living here. I love Alaska so much.
No kidding, really?
Yes. I've been in Texas all my life, and this is beautiful here.
That more beautiful than Texas?
Oh, much more beautiful than Texas. Are you kidding me? I love it.
Reporting from Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to the uninhabited village of King Island, west of Nome in the Bering Sea. King Island residents were forced to relocate to Nome in 1959. But this month, a group of former residents and their descendants are returning to the island.
My name is Vince Picuana. I'm from King Island. Well, to us King Islanders, it's a paradise for us and one of a kind that I grew up on. I've been to all over other islands and There's no island like it. The air is fresh, and you can smell the island when you get there, and you can hear the birds, of all kinds of birds. The Eskimo dance after the one man gets a polar bear, what they would call unikshak, kind of like a potluck, and divide the skin, share the food, and you give away ropes to the men. When me and my friend Boots Notango caught a snow bunting with bow and arrow, I caught one first, and then he caught one, and with only the bow and arrow. And then when they were gonna do the polar bear dance, they let us go in the middle of the men while the men were dancing, and they told us to release the spirits of the snow bundings, or to encourage us to be a good hunters, you know. Very awakening experience for me and my friend. Anyway, I'm going to go back on next month. This month sometime, by way of helicopter, the elders here from Nome, and we're going to go first class.
Vince Picuana grew up in King Island. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Aaron Selbig, Annie Feit, Alex Duer, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Stephanie Joyce.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's show, you can find it online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Tony Gorman in Valdez, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety. The Alaska Nanook Commission reminds you that harassing polar bears or taking polar bears with cubs is not only illegal, but it is not part of Native traditions. Together with their management partners at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Alaska Nanook Commission has been working on developing a long-term polar bear deterrence plan to protect Alaska's villages from dangerous polar bear encounters. More at thealaskanannookcommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission, Alaska's people managing Alaska's resources.
This is APRN, the Alaska...